The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now, as you've been hearing, a verdict of unlawful killing was found in the Stardust inquest yesterday. And for families, it represents justice for their loved ones who died on that night in February of 1981.
Well, to me, I got justice for my mum, and I now know the truth of what happened that day. The truth is out there. Everybody knows the truth. And that's what means so much to me, that to me, I can get on now with the rest of my life and be a better parent to my own children, give my own children the mother that they deserved, the mother that I deserved.
Very emotional day for all the families here. All of us for 43 years had to fight, and we shouldn't have had to have done that. They should have been sorted and done long ago. So we just like to say to the 48 now that we're taking you out of the flames, the darkness and the smoke of the Stardust.
Feel vindicated today that we've got truth, we've got the justice. And now I think it's time that the Irish state actually apologise to each and every one of us.
It's a significant day, a very important day. The victims got what was long overdue to them, they should have gotten 43, 42 years ago. But as a family member and the experience, it's a bittersweet day.
And the late Charlie Bird covered the tragedy for RTE News in 1981.
So at this stage, you don't know where he is?
We don't know where he is, no. I presume he's dead, to be honest with you.
The whole thing all happened so quick. The flames all start coming towards us. The heat was... it was terrible. It was like being in an oven.
Here at the Stardust Club in Artane, the work of sifting through the debris has been going on all day. The experts say that it may take up to a week to complete this job. Teresa, could you tell me about the numbers of people who were in the Stardust on Friday night?
I can, because everyone coming in the door on the night of an extension or a disc or anything else, anyone going with an extension, has to have a meal ticket coming in. And I had 775 meal tickets paid up that night. I was just making up the cash, in fact, when this happened. We went out, we were outside the door then, and even outside I still didn't believe it was so bad until the total thing came out afterwards. Because the front of the wall didn't look, you know, was it all inside.
There was more panic outside, I think, than there could have been inside.
There were so many people trying to get back in.
Trying to get back in to their friends and their girlfriends and everything. They thought they could help them inside.
Meanwhile, here at the local church in Artane, which is less than half a mile from the club, special prayers were offered this morning for the dead and injured. The local community is still recovering from the horrible events of early Saturday morning. In his sermon, local priest Father Pat McCabe spoke about the tragedy.
Death is always hard. And grown-up children know that a time will come when their parents must die. But there seems to be something almost unnatural about parents who bury their children. The young people who lost their lives in the Stardust fire have left their parents, their brothers, sisters, and friends. They were called home early by God.
And in the congregation, many people wept openly. For others, they could barely hold back their grief.
And that report from the late Charlie Bird. Sean Reinhardt was 18 when it happened, and he's on the line now. Sean, good morning.
How are you doing, Pat? Very nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me on.
What do you remember of that night? I'm sure it's etched on your brain.
Oh, yeah, sure. It never leaves anybody, Pat. I remember the whole night fairly well, and although it's all that time ago, you know, we were just young fellas out looking to have a bit of crack with the lads. We'd go out, we'd have a few beers in the Silver Swan. We'd meet there, have a few drinks, and we'd mosey from there into the Stardust.
I mean, this would have been a regular thing. Although it was a Valentine's occasion in 1981, but I mean, it would have been a typical weekend activity.
Of course, it's something that we'd all looked forward to, you know, because we were young kids and you know, some of us lucky enough to have a job, we'd have a field bob to go out the weekend and a regular thing. But like, you know, nobody should have been drinking before they were 18. But
well, you know, nothing's changed there, I can tell you.
Nothing's changed, no. And it was a regular hunt for us, and we loved it. Like we just loved the whole buzz of going out meeting each other, you know.
Yeah. So then you went into the Stardust after being in the Silver Swan for a couple of pints, what was the scene like? I mean, I'm sure it was one of gaiety and happiness and crack.
Yeah, and that wouldn't be memorable. Do you know what I mean? Because it was just a normal night, like, you know. But there's always a great crowd there, and you know, you meet up with a few pals you had a drink with earlier. We'd have to go in separately almost, you know, because bouncers at the time wouldn't allow you in unless you know, there were couples, and you'd be borrowing a friend's sister to walk in the door with you, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Just to get yourself inside, and then you'd see who ended up inside, and you end up with your gang of lads sitting together at a table, and, you know, one or two might drift in afterwards who you weren't expecting, and it was great crack.
How did you become aware of the fire?
Well, I was actually sitting down I was facing the dance floor, you know. There was a dance competition going on, and I didn't know the fire was actually to my back and sort of left shoulder, and I didn't see it at all. And then I remember a girl running towards my table, and she jumped up onto the table and jumped out past my right shoulder. She was obviously heading for the main exit.
Yeah, so she was running from something.
She was running. She would have been able to see the fire to her right hand side, and I couldn't see it. And she was running to get to the fire exit, which was like most of us would have gone in and out the main exit that we were familiar with.
Yeah.
And then a pal of mine, I didn't know what that was. Like, I was taken aback by this event, somebody jumping up on your table. And the pal of mine just came up to me and he said, Sean, the place is on fire. He said, get your coat and get out. And I stood up calmly, still didn't see anything. And then when I turned around, I saw the blaze in the alcove. There was the flames are bursting down from the roof, and the seat had also, they had this sort of a tiered seating system, you know, like being in a stadium, so you could look down at the stage. And that had been cordoned off, you know, that area, that alcove, with it like a screen or a curtain of some sort. And the red leatherette foamy seating that caught fire as well, but it was more or less confined to there. That's where the main blaze was. Now there was flames and smoke gushing out, and then I took a few steps towards the main exit, which was the entrance I used to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And just after a couple of steps, then the lights went out. And just exactly the way you reacted now, there was a collective gasp. So if you can multiply what you've done by 800, you could hear that, and moment I'll never, ever forget. That collective gasp and girls started screaming, and like the flames then just shot across the ceiling, and it was even difficult to see the flames. It was like, I don't know, the smoke was so dense, you know, and that horrible smell you'd get from a burning tire maybe. And the noise, the sound of crackling, and I don't know, you could barely see the flames at some stage because the smoke was so dense that you just see these orangey red. It was just like a picture from hell, you know. And
I mean, you're terrifying me even now with your description. Now,
yeah, it's like, I honestly, Pat, to be quite honest with you, I can't say it any other way. And to be honest with you as well, even at the time, I don't think I was terrified, because I just didn't have time for fear. It's just hard to explain. I remember with a remarkable experience I had. I remember actually, it was almost out of body. I could see myself from above, and I remember falling to my knees. I was just becoming overcome with the dense smoke, and I remember saying out loud, I said, oh God, I'm going to die. And I said that out loud. And then I didn't even think of escape. I just knew for a fact I was going to die. And I hadn't got time to be afraid. It was just happening. And I fell to the floor on my knees. And I remember being on my knees. And then I didn't realise this, but I actually went unconscious. And I didn't realise until I only found out a day or two later, because when I described the scene after getting out, there was a guard came up to the hospital and he was able to put together a time frame. And I realised, and I had been in there a lot longer than I thought. It's just when you're knocked out and then you come around, there's no sense of a passage of time. Do you know what I mean? It's not like sleeping.
So how did you get out?
I came around on the floor. The air is a bit clearer down lower. And I came around again. I didn't know I had been knocked out, but I did come around. And I got up. I had been burned already. My face and my hair, my hands, anywhere I didn't have clothing was burned. And I was able to stand up, and I saw this white thing in front of me. It was a girl. It was a white blouse. And she was probably about a foot away from me. And I remember at the time I was actually being credited with saving the girl's life, which wasn't true at all. She actually saved my life. Neither of us knew where we were going. We couldn't communicate with each other even, you know. I was just amazed to be where I still was. And I put my arms under her, oxters like under her arms. And I think we thought we were still heading towards the main exit, but we didn't. We actually came out another door. And I don't know how a miracle that we got out there at all, you know. And got outside then, and it was bedlam outside. There was the green area, the lawn at the front of the stairs was covered in people lying down, coughing and being treated with burns and stuff like this by first aiders. And there was a pal of mine up there who saw me. He didn't recognise me because my face was burned. And a very clever chap, Tony Rock. And he was really clever because I asked him, was everybody out? And he said, yeah. He told me everybody was out, not to worry. And it sort of made me feel at ease. And I was going to actually head home. I just didn't realise how badly I was burned. And then a gang of young girls were around me. And one of them said, oh, look at his face. And I realised then there was something up, and I saw my hands, like my fingernails had melted into my fingers. And I think they took me out into the street, onto the Kilmore Road. And there was two elderly women who had a care. And they put myself and another young lad into the back of their car. God help them, because we weren't showing any appreciation. We were effing and blinding, you know, the two poor women trying to help us, telling them to go through, break red lights and stuff like this, because the tools were, we were burning up with the pain. And they got us to the Mater Hospital. And when we got inside to the Mater, it was bedlam in the Mater, and they didn't have the staff. Obviously, they wouldn't be prepared for something like that, and I'm sure it was the same in every other hospital. But there wasn't any doctor available, like, for a lot of us. And I remember another girl came in that I had known, a lovely girl, and she wasn't burned as badly as me, but she still, I could see a burn on the side of her face, and it must have been a very humiliating experience for our God lover, because her blouse was burned off and she was walking around like in a bra, God help her. I felt so sad for her. But the two of us took a stroll somewhere in the hospital, and we found a sink, a really deep sink, and she was able to turn the taps on, and we took turns putting our heads under the water to cool down. And eventually then they got a doctor that could see me, and he just put me up on a table and started jabbing painkillers into my ass. I don't know how many injections I had, but I got plenty of them anyway. And then we were, some guy, it wasn't a hospital worker, some chap took me upstairs. They told him where to bring me into, up to some ward, and there was doctors up in the ward discharging your ordinary run-of-the-mill patients. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They were all being discharged and sent home at whatever time it was, 3 a.m. or whatever, and just to make beds for us. And I remember I was put into a bed, and I think I had so many painkillers then. I was, I think somebody came in, they had to cut, I had rings on my fingers that they cut off with a some sort of a tool, and I went to sleep actually and woke up the next morning
to the realization that 48 people had died and many people like yourself had suffered burns. It was, you know, thought immediately that this would be sorted, that there would be inquests, that would be a definitive understanding of what happened, but it has taken all this time since 1981 to get to the truth. And yeah, nobody expected it could ever take that long.
No, I remember. I remember afterwards, myself and John Keegan got we go to him. We, John was the chairman of the Stardust Victims Committee, and I was the PRO. And I remember having a chat with John, you know, and we thought, and John was such a Trojan worker. He was a workhorse. He left absolutely no stone unturned, you know. And I just got that feeling with him that this is going to be wrapped up in a matter of months, you know, because he wrote to absolutely everybody. And Antoinette was his, like his personal secretary, and she wrote to everybody and done absolutely everything he requested of her. And we thought this would be wrapped up. I just can't believe, you know, that it's gone on so long.
And I think listening to the way you describe the night itself and how long it's taken, it's maybe hard for the rest of us to understand how much this means for the families.
Yeah, like, I'll be honest with you, Pat, I'm absolutely elated. I just can't describe how happy I am today. I'm so happy for the 48. I'm so happy for their families, you know. It's like, I'm cognizant of the fact that there's people who lost kids in there and they're listening to this, but burning to death, like, it's atrocious. Yeah. And this actually gives them some dignity. And it gives, I don't know, it vindicates the bitterness and the hurt we felt all these years, how we were treated, and in particular how they were treated and disrespected all these years.
There, this outcome has been long awaited, and I'm sure the elation you felt, and you know, you feel like you're walking on air. The one time in my life that I've ever been elated was after an exam that I thought I'd fail, and I didn't. And I understood for the first time what walking on air meant. And I bet you had that feeling yesterday.
And I hope it never goes away, Pat. I feel absolutely tremendous. I swear to God, I really feel tremendous. It's like winning 6 All-Irelands in a row.
and tell us, you know, your burns, did they heal, or have they had lifelong scars? Or
Well, I still have scars, but my burns, they turned out to be very superficial. Like, like at the time, I remember in the hospital in the morning, I'll just tell you a story. We were burned and our faces were completely burned off. Now, there's a photograph of me in the Irish Times, I think, that was taken. They released me for Paul Wade's funeral. I got out of hospital, and that was, would have been the last funeral, because Paul was never identified. And so they let me out of hospital for that. But the day after the fire, I remember actually going to use the bathroom, and I went into the toilet and I looked in the mirror and I turned around to see who was standing behind me, and it was me that was in the mirror, my reflection, but you couldn't make out any features of most of our faces. And I remember lying in the bed, and this guy came in to visit somebody who was across from me, and it turned out that the person across from me was a girl, and then he heard me speaking, and when he heard my male voice, he started giving out that he didn't want his girlfriend in a ward with a man. Do you know, it was sort of a funny moment, but it just showed none of us had any features left. But having said that, like 10 days after, when I was at Paul's funeral, the most of my face, the scabs had fallen off, and most of it was like having new skin, you know. And my scars are mainly on my hands where they cut skin off, and I look fine and feel fine.
Well, now. Sean, thank you for reliving that for us, because I think the true horror, I remember the shock when I saw the headlines and understood, I knew the area obviously, and the shock of losing 48 young people in such a horrendous fashion still lives with me. But I think you brought it back vividly for us, and I know maybe if there's anyone impacted by our conversation, the Samaritans are always available at 116 123. But Sean, thank you very, very much for sharing your experience with us.
And thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much. Well, listening to that, Christine Bowen, Deputy Editor of the Journal.ie, Executive Producer of the Stardust podcast. Christine, I don't think we could have got a more vivid description of what unfolded that night.
No, and as Sean was talking, I kept thinking about how he was just a kid at the time. And I think that's something for everyone I think people need to realise that, you know, people at the Stardust, the average age of the victims was 19 that night. This was very much, young people at the very, very start of their lives. And to hear what he is describing there, it's so vivid and it's so brutal. And even though it was 43 years ago, I think for people to hear about exactly what happened that night, to hear the details, and that's something that the inquest did so well, where they brought it to life, where they explained to everyone exactly what happened, that this isn't something from Ireland's history. It's not a story that happened a long time ago. You know, there's still survivors. People are still, the impact that this has had has lingered so much, and it's been such a huge thing for the people who were affected by it.
And the elation that Sean felt obviously was shared by other survivors and family members of those who died. And the question of what can happen next. I mean, an apology from Simon Harris. I mean, when you look at Simon Harris, you know, he wasn't born when this happened. And, you know, an apology from the state for whatever errors were made over the past, it will be welcome. But maybe more vindication is required in terms of a Garda inquiry.
Yeah, and I think what's going to happen now is the coroner is obliged, so that's Dr. Myra Cullinan, who ran the inquest, she's obliged to inform the DPP, so the Director of Public Prosecutions, of the outcome of the inquests, and then a decision will be made on whether there would be any criminal prosecutions. From talking to lawyers and legal teams who are involved in the case, it doesn't seem likely that there would be a criminal case coming from this. And that's partly because of the amount of time that's elapsed, but also because, for legal reasons, say the company that ran the Stardust doesn't exist anymore. So there wouldn't be able to be kind of a criminal case taken against the company. There would be basically legal difficulties in any kind of criminal case. But I think the option that some people may be looking at now would be civil cases instead. So for the families to have this verdict, it would allow some of them or all of them to consider options that would be looking at civil responsibility instead. I think the apology is obviously a huge thing. I think the options open for the government and for Simon Harris are either to apologise for what happened at the time or for the delay in this. You know, there were inquests held for the victims in 1981 and they were very brief. They were cursory. They only lasted a couple of days. But at the time, a lot of the information that we found out through the inquest today, it was known in 1981. Like, there was no reason why this should have taken 43 years. Like, we knew at the time that there were issues with the doors being chained. This all came out immediately. There were issues around the carpet tiles being used on the wall, which were very flammable. There were issues around the main door wasn't suitable as an emergency exit. And these are all things that contributed to the jury yesterday ruling that it was an unlawful killing. So I think for the families to get that vindication with the verdict was one thing. But I think the next thing will be for the state to acknowledge why there was such a delay, and an apology would go some way towards that.
Christine, Deputy Editor of the Journal.ie, Executive Producer of the Stardust podcast. Christine, I presume the podcast is still available.
It is, yeah. So we actually recorded a very quick episode of it last night, just kind of direct from the scene. Myself and my co-host Nikki Ryan were in the room at the time as the verdict was read out. So it was just describing what it was like. And just from talking to the families and the sense of relief, like I've never seen anything like that in my time in journalism. Just being in that room was just, it was something else. So we did an extra episode just all about that.
Christine Bowen, Deputy Editor of thejournal.ie, Executive Producer of the Stardust podcast. Once again, thank you very much. Some of the comments coming in. The gentleman speaking about the Stardust is to be admired, to be so strong, to speak about his description of that night. It's so profound. He's made the stupid things we moan about. He's brought them into perspective. Along with other speakers we've heard too. That's from Laura. I remember the Stardust as a 21-year-old at the time. We knew it could have been any one of us anywhere in the country. A very moving interview. I wonder still why it took so long to get this verdict. That's from Mike. Powerful testimony from Sean. My first cousin was in the Stardust that night and escaped with minor burns to his hands. God bless all of those who perished and were badly injured. That man is painting a verbal picture of that appalling night. It is powerful radio. How the hell did it take this long for this inquiry to happen? From Dee in Kerry. Once in 20 years, an interview comes along that makes you cry. This is one of them. May they rest in peace. That's from Mike Burke. I would like to thank that wonderful man who's telling his story of the Stardust tragedy. I'm reliving his horrendous story with him right now and wishing him and all his family and everyone else affected by this night a happy and healthy life going forward.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.